Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Who are they?
Planet people.
They've got some strange belief.
Magic. It's always magic.
He was swinging a kind of plumb bob.
To bring on the magic. What else?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. President Macron goes on the TV to call for calm. What does he get? Four dead at the Strasbourg Christmas market. And no questions asked about the so-called killer. The gendarmes say they called out to Sherif Shakat, but he shot first, and so they shot him dead. And China-Canada tit-for-tat started by Washington. Kidnapping each other's top executives. Is this Trump's hardball trade negotiations? Just as he spells out in his book, The Art of the Deal between America and China? And nearly 10,000 electronic voting machines are torched in the Democratic Republic of Congo this week, which looks set to delay the presidential election even further than the 2 years it's already been put off. And we go to the belly of the beast and ask a retired Lloyds banker how the bankers became the banksters and what we and our politicians need to do to get them back in the box. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week, Matthew Alford from Bath University on his new book, The Union Jackboot, What Your Media and Professors Don't Tell You About British Foreign Policy. And also the continuing VI paedophile cover-up with former Met Detective John Wedger. Full interview with him. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. But Martin, we've had a rare appearance from the Director General of MI6 this week. Can you just put people in the picture? What is MI6? So we know there's a great big building just next to Vauxhall Bridge on the south side there. It looks like something out of the Lord of the Rings, some kind of spooky tower. But what does MI6 actually do?
Well, it's hard to know because they're supposedly secret. And so, I mean, in the past, we wouldn't have even known who the head of MI6 was. So the fact that he's going out there and doing PR for the organisation is a bit of a development because in the past, of course, they were just in the shadows and nobody knew who they were.
These are the people that run the James Bonds of the world. But how like James Bond are they, really?
Well, I mean, the fact is that MI6 doesn't have a reputation. It's got a reputation of being very devious and extremely effective at what it does, but at the same time, outside Britain, it's not regarded as an entirely, an entirely positive institution. Well, in the Middle East, for example, it's regarded as a terrorist-supporting infrastructure, which of course it is.
Even in the UK, it gets quite a bit of criticism too.
Well, indeed, especially in places like Northern Ireland, where they had their fingerprint very prominently displayed.
The idea. What was the connection with MI6?
Well, I mean, there was a turf war between MI6 and MI5 about whether it was a foreign country, in which case MI6 would take primacy, or whether it was internal, in which case MI5 would take primacy. I understand at one stage they were grassing each other's agents up so that they could be assassinated. That's how bad the relationship sometimes became between those two organisations.
So this chap by the name of Alex Younger is now the Director General. What do you know about him?
Hardly anything. What we do know, Scarlett, who used to head it up, if you remember, you know, we never used to know who these people were. I mean, he's basically a retired head of MI6, and he's come out and said, well, Jeremy Corbyn can't be Prime Minister because he's a security risk. And I think I was saying, hang on a minute, we pay your wages, you're a civil servant, effectively, and you think that you can come out with stuff like that. And, of course, it's what's been uncovered this week, that things funded by the Foreign Office under the table, based in Scotland, have been basically been Twitter trolls out there attacking Corbyn as being a puppet of Putin. And that they justify that as being their war against Putin's infiltration of our society. And in actual fact, what it actually turns out to be is the usual thing they get up to, which is slagging off the Labour leadership and trying to prevent them win elections in our own in this country.
That maybe even taxpayers' money's been being spent on trying to undermine Corbyn. How on earth is that allowed?
Well, it's, the Labour MPs have been, because it came out through a leak, yeah? And the Labour MPs have been pretty annoyed about it, but it's hardly surprising. They've been doing that for years. The Zinoviev letter, which undermined the first Labour government, was an MI6 plant. It was just they just disinfo, you know, it helped to bring down the first Labour government because the security services basically serve the establishment, and their role is basically to prevent social change in Britain and elsewhere in the world.
So secret Scottish-based, I'll put a link up to this on our show page, a secret Scottish-based office led information warfare attack on Labour and Jeremy Corbyn. Explosive leaked documents passed to the Sunday Mail. This is the dailyrecord.co.uk Scotland website. Reveal the organisation's integrity initiative is funded with £2 million of Foreign Office cash and run by military intelligence specialists.
Indeed, and of course the speech she made at St Andrews, the head of MI6 this week, was saying, well, we've got to this fourth generation intelligence warfare, the Russians are trying to steer elections and control our infrastructure and this, that and the other, and we need more resources to fight this. And in fact what he's doing is he's telling us what MI6 gets up to and then saying that the Russians are doing that.
So a secret UK government funded InfoWars unit based in Scotland sent out social media posts attacking Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. On the surface, the cryptically named Institute for Statecraft is a small charity operating from an old Victorian mill in Fife. You couldn't make it up, could you? This sounds like something from the Avengers. But explosive leaked documents passed to the Sunday Mail reveal the organisation's integrity initiative is funded £2 million of Foreign Office cash and run by these military intelligence officers. The think tank is supposed to counter Russian online propaganda by forming clusters of friendly journalists and key influencers throughout Europe who use social media to hit back against Russian disinformation. But their investigations found worrying evidence the shadowy programme's official Twitter account has been used just to attack Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party and their officials. One tweet quotes a newspaper article calling Corbyn a useful idiot that goes on to state his open, visceral anti-Westernism has helped the Kremlin cause.
Well, there you are. You see, they justify this to themselves in, oh, well, we've got to have £2 million of your money, folks, to be spent trying to counter Russian propaganda online. But, of course, they don't come out and say, we've been funded by the British government to do this. They basically pretend to be people they're not. This is what's really pernicious about it. They don't say we're the Institute for Statecraft and we're funded by the Foreign Office.
You know what Alex Younger will say? Well, the Russians are doing it, so we
well, I mean,
do it
too. Do you know what the Russians would say? We don't waste our money on stuff like that. We've got a proper intelligence services which is bugging your phones. So that's when they got the telephone intercept between Catherine Ashton and Umas Piets, where Umas Piets, the Estonian foreign minister, told Catherine Ashton, in actual fact, the snipers in the Maidan Square are associated with the new regime.
This is in Ukraine.
The Russians concentrate on old-fashioned tradecraft. It's the boondoggle in the West now is that everything is psychological warfare, which becomes PR, which means all these ex-military people can then get government contracts to go out and be trolls on the internet. Nice work if you can get it. You're paid by the government to pretend to be somebody you're not and generally try and influence opinion.
So,
but of course the Russians don't waste their time on this stuff.
We've heard a bit about
waste
MI6 time. And we'll be hearing from Alex Younger in a minute, the Director General. What about MI5 and GCHQ, the other two large parts of the Secret Service here? We've heard just this last week GCHQ have the power to legally hack anybody. So actually hacking is a criminal offence, but GCHQ are immune. Earlier this year we heard that MI5 is allowed to go around and commit criminal offences and has immunity. Now presumably, almost certainly, this is some form of crown immunity that these people have got. So effectively they're above the law.
Well, they always have been. The idea that they operated within the law is just a fantasy. They've never operated within the law. And, of course, their allies, the CIA, are famous drug traffickers and supporters of international terrorism.
So, really, they are what we might call the permanent government. Nobody elects these people, and they go for years and years and years. Governments come and go, but the people at the top echelons of these organisations continue on and on.
Well, that's why
public money.
Well, that's why Scarlett, who used to head up MI6, thinks it's in his job description as a retired head to decide who should and shouldn't be Prime Minister of the country. Now, of course, there's no constitutional basis for that at all, but it quite shows the mindset that they have. No, it's all very well you having elections, but we decide what happens, and I'm afraid Corbyn can't be elected.
So why haven't the Labour Party, why hasn't Jeremy Corbyn been making more this week of the Integrity Initiative, who's based at Gateside Mill near Auchtermurty, retweeted a Newsray paper report that said Milne is not a spy. That would be beneath him. And his strategy and communication director, Seamus Mill, has been also targeted by them. So why hasn't Jeremy Corbyn called this out? This is British taxpayers' money being spent on attacking the Labour Party and its leaders and its director of communication.
Well, I think various Labour MPs have called it out. I think Corbyn is trying to look pro-ministerial and trying to stand above it. Of course they're doing that, but I don't care.
What will happen with this is this organisation will close down. You'll go there probably this weekend and find there's nobody at this mill, and in a couple of weeks' time it will pop up somewhere else under a different name.
That's right. This is how these things operate. There's a huge kind of privatised industry now of ex-military intelligence people who are basically PR wonks. Yeah, that's what psychological warfare is all about. Is Alistair Campbell in a uniform, and you've got it, you know. And these guys have a sales pitch to governments. I mean, one of the things Cambridge Analytica said.
Just a minute, Alistair Campbell was the one. It's almost certain now was responsible for outing David Kelly to the national press, which then supposedly has caused him to commit suicide. So he was very, very much involved in that, and he should have been possibly even prosecuted after the inquest, which there was never any proper inquest into that particular death. Now, maybe that is because people like David Kelly, who are working for the Secret Services, are above the law and actually are outside the law. And when it looks as if there's some criminal offence involving them, everything is just brushed under the carpet.
Well, we know that this is what goes on. Cambridge Analytica's parent company did a sales pitch at Dicey a couple of years ago, which is a military sales expert. They said, "What could we do for you guys? Well, we could run a false flag chemical weapons attack on London, which wouldn't be real, but we could convince people it was real, and then the government of the day, on the back of that, could then pursue any policy it wanted."
Well,
that was a presentation
shocking.
That's
pretty shocking. Do you know? Can you source that?
It's already sourced. We can source it later and
on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. Anyway, before that, let's have a listen finally to, not finally, but we should get round to it at least. It's 17 minutes past 7 o'clock, and we should have been here 10 minutes ago, really. But anyway, fascinating discussion about the Secret Services and the law. Let's have a listen to the Director General of MI6, Alex Younger, talking here about Russia.
We face adversaries who now regard themselves as being in a state of perpetual confrontation. One of the most egregious examples of this was the attack in Salisbury, in which the Russian state used a military-grade chemical weapon on UK soil. We did not respond to this flagrant hostile act by emulating Russian tactics. Instead, we operationalized our values, our legal system, and our alliances. Our intention is for the Russian state to conclude that whatever benefits it thinks it is accruing from this activity, they are not worth the risk. We will do this in our way, according to our laws and our values. We will be successful nonetheless, and I urge Russia or any other state intent on subverting our way of life not to underestimate our determination and our capabilities, or those of our allies. We can do this to any opponent at any time.
Ooh, it's almost like a bit of a veiled threat there. But Martin, actually, he's really taking the moral high ground by saying, even after Salisbury, we've decided we are not going to retaliate.
Well, my own opinion is that MI6 are behind the Salisbury incident, so it's all crocodile tears, isn't it?
What evidence have you got for that?
Well, let's think about, if you think about it logically, who controls Salisbury? Is it the Russians or is it the British? Who controls Salisbury? So two guys supposedly got off a plane and went there the night before. They were smoking loads of dope in the hotel they were in, having noisy sex with prostitutes. They sound like a hit squad to you?
Well, if they were the hit squad, they may be a hit squad, or they may be an incompetent hit squad.
Well, and if the Russians wanted Skripal dead, why would they use this so-called Novichok, which didn't actually kill them?
What it does is it paints a picture of the Russian intelligence as rather bungling.
Well, what it does is it's basically the whole thing is theatre, and including the death of the woman with the so-called Novichok perfume. The MI6 are quite capable of killing random people in order to make their point. They were involved in the Bologna bombing of 1980, according to the Italian police force. Western intelligence services, NATO, are terrorists. They were the ones who orchestrated the snipers in the Maidan Square that killed 80 protesters and several police officers. It wasn't the Yanukovych regime, it was our people. And the assassination of Zakhachenko in August this year was carried out with a bomb attack, which killed him and his bodyguard in a cafe. And all the evidence points to the Ukrainian secret service working with British intelligence for that assassination.
So how close are the British intelligence and special forces to what's going on in Ukraine?
Very close. We understand that Brigade 77 have been virtually moved lock, stock and barrel to Kiev.
Well,
Brigade 77, as they've told us about, is Britain's cyber warfare crew. And they've got 1,000 employees, all of whom are officers, so you can imagine the amount of money's been spent on this. They're not squaddies. And they spend all day online pretending to be people they're not, pushing anti-Russian propaganda about things like Skripal. That's exactly what they do, and we pay for that. And then it's presented as if there's all this opinion against Russia on internet,
public
on social media.
They're
running it.
On publictechnology.net, Alex Younger is reported as calling for tech-enabled fourth-generation espionage. He says that digital technology has profoundly changed the work of his organisation, and he called for a new era of espionage that melds human and artificial intelligence. In that public address we heard a bit from earlier, he says, "I do not expect our human intelligence role will ever change fundamentally. We will always need to understand the motivations, intentions and aspirations of people in other countries. Even in an era of AI, you need human intelligence. In fact, it will become an even more important in a more complex world." But he added that the rapid speed of technological development has been a key contributing factor to making the world a dramatically more complicated place. And he's really talking about investing in AI as part of MI6's toolkit.
Well, indeed. I mean, I think what's very interesting about his speech is he's basically giving you a prospectus of what MI6 actually do.
Well,
and they're basically glorified PR consultants who go out pretending to be, you know, they create astroturf movements, they create a general atmosphere of anti-Russian hysteria, and of course that's what the Skripal incident is all about. And we've not spoken to Skripal, or his daughter, or the police officer who was supposedly involved. And we know we got a letter in the Times by one of the doctors in the hospital saying that nobody was treated for nerve gas poisoning in that hospital. Three people were treated for poisoning, is what he said, but it wasn't nerve gas.
Alex Younger claims the era of the fourth industrial revolution calls for a fourth generation espionage. This, he says, will see human skills complemented by the power of new technologies. The work of the intelligence services evolving in three major ways. The first is that as countries' defences are being probed on multiple fronts at the same time, developing effective partnerships between organisations is the key to national security, involving greater collaboration with MI6, as well as working with other agencies across intelligence and law enforcement with our overseas allies. The second, he says, the second big change is the need to master covert action in the data age. When I joined SIS, he said our principal task was finding out secrets. In a world of hybrid threats, it's not enough to know what your adversary is doing. You must be able to take steps to change their behaviour. Well, this is clearly psychological warfare investment he's talking about here. The third challenge is for MI6 to overcome the need to ensure that technology is on our side, not that of our opponents.
Well, in other words, what he's saying is that what we're doing, is what we're accusing the Russians of doing, is we're setting up troll factories to try and influence public opinion.
Psychological warfare and cyber warfare.
Now, what the Russians do, and I think this is, the Russians are blamed for doing, the West loves this colour revolution stuff, you know, where we introduce a new phone app into Cuba and then we get young people to criticise the government and all the rest of it. The Russians are aware of this is going on because they're on the receiving end of it. But you know what? They stick to traditional tradecraft. That phone call that they intercepted, as I mentioned earlier, between Umas Pierce and Catherine Ashton, that's what Secret Services are supposed to do. We've got your phone conversation, and we're now going to tell everybody what you're saying amongst yourself, because in actual fact the assassinations,
yeah,
the murders were carried.
This, Martin,
I know, but this is the difference between the Russian approach and their approach.
GCHQ is that this week they also brought out, there was a report on Points West which didn't go up on the BBC website, but what GCHQ were pointing out is that you may be buying smart toys for Christmas. This is cuddly toys with things like little microphones and little loudspeakers inside them and little integrated circuits that are Wi-Fi or Bluetooth compatible. And they showed on Points West, and GCHQ are pointing this out, that what the Points West reporter was sitting with someone from GCHQ in the room with a couple of these cuddly toys, and the school kids outside on their smartphones were listening into everything they were saying. So these toys actually enable complete strangers to listen into your own home and your conversations and the conversations of your children.
Well, I mean, the CIA were definitely involved in the creation of Facebook and Google so that they can spy on the whole population, as Edward Snowden has revealed. But of course, the Russian secret services still use typewriters which are individually checkable, so they keep card index files. Not super
Facebook,
stuff like this at all.
Facebook poses a potential threat to democracy, says the ex-chief of GCHQ. Robert Hannigan said the social network must be controlled and it must be regulated. It's very easy to say, but in a way, when the mainstream press, the mass media, is extremely so controlled as to come out with a whole load of fake news about weapons of mass destruction and help start an illegal war, surely social media nowadays is almost all we've got.
Well, I think the fact of the matter is people are going to have different opinions about things, and you can't really stop them. And you can go out there and try and, bamboozle them. But this secret unit that's been doing this stuff is not supposed to exist, and we're not supposed to know it's there. But they're spending £2 million of our money trying to brainwash us with government propaganda. That would be unacceptable in any real constitutional democracy. Everybody's allowed their opinion, and the government shouldn't be spending money to try and bend people's minds.
So does Facebook pose a potential threat to democracy?
I think what poses a threat to democracy is the oligarchic control of the whole system of communications that we have. You know, the dominance of the media of people like Murdoch and the social media by people like Zuckerberg.
He said that Facebook was not, this is Robert Hannigan, said Facebook was not a fluffy charity providing free services to user, but rather social media firms were trying to squeeze every drop of profit from everyone's personal data. The former intelligence chief was sceptical about whether tech giants could reform themselves and said that new laws would be required. Not that that's a major priority for the present government.
No, I know the world we're living in is a cacophony of different voices, and one of the problems they've got is they can't control the narratives in the way they used to. People can go online and get alternative sources of information, and that means that the lazy lies that they used to get away with, we may come to discuss what's happened in Strasbourg before the end of the programme, they just push that out there, and of course nowadays people look into it immediately and start asking questions, whereas in the 1970s we were talking about earlier, they couldn't do that. They have to take years before any of this stuff came out. It's now almost instantaneous, and that does create a problem for the mind managers.
Hint, hint, yes, let's talk about France now. And first of all, I suppose, look at the Yellow Jackets protest, Martin. There has been very little coverage of what these people are actually demanding. What we hear is it's about taxes, it's about disposable income, it's about the income gap widening. But there is, on social media, quite a lot circulating of the various demands. One particular picture of a Yellow Jacket, it's all in French. 25 propositions to sort out the crisis is what it is. I think that's the English translation, where they divide up various demands into work and economy, politics, health and environment, and foreign affairs. All sorts of fascinating topics in there. Well, I'll put a link up to that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, saying basically a various number of things, one of which Macron, by the way, said no chance, which is about increasing taxes on the rich. He said in the economy, let's just look at one of those sections, a constitutional cap on taxes, all taxes, of 25%, an increase of 40% in basic pension and social welfare, increase hiring in public sector to re-establish public services. They want massive construction projects to house 5 million homeless, severe penalties for mayors and prefectures that leave people on the streets. They want a breakup of the too big to fail banks, a re-separate regular banking from investment banking, and they want to cancel the debts accrued through usurious rates of interest.
Well, I mean, some of those things I strongly agree with, but the problem with a movement like the Yellow Jackets is that everybody's involved, and anybody can say that they're a Yellow Jacket and these are my demands. So it's, you know, everybody, I mean, the school students have been protesting, are protesting about the changes to university entrance.
Well, that's one of these demands in here, and what's happening is people are saying, well, actually, my demand is in there, I'm going to put on a Yellow Jacket and off
I go. Well, I mean, this is the logic of this is how the French Revolution happened, or the English Civil War, or whatever. Yes. Because people come out and
what they've done, I think, quite successfully is they've created a manifesto for a united front in France.
Well, they have, but I think it's skin deep. I think you'll find that people have got rather. I mean, they're saying that they want to increase public expenditure, but they want to reduce taxes, and that means you're going to have a big budget deficit. There's nothing wrong with that. But you've got to be clear. That's what
have QE. Well, for example, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell are considering this idea of printing money QE for the people here in Britain.
Well, I think that's definitely on the agenda if there's a crash. But of course, before there's a crash, you've got.
Well, it would be nice if it was before the
crash.
Well, I mean,
it would. I mean, I think it's obviously this movement is significant. I think the left in the National Assembly have brought forward a vote of no confidence in Macron, but they won't win it because they've only got 57 MPs because of the first past the post double round system they have there.
Let's just look at another one of their areas, because I was fascinated to see that they've got some demands on health and environment. No more planned obsolescence, they say. Mandate guarantee from producers that their products will last 10 years and the spare parts will be available during that period. Well, that's like having a 10-year guarantee when you buy something. Sounds very sensible. Ban plastic bottles and other polluting packaging. Very good idea. And actually, I think that most of the press is pushing for that, and the government, many governments would welcome that. Weaken the influence of big pharmaceutical companies on health in general and hospitals in particular. Ban GMO crops, carcinogenic pesticides, endocrine disruptors and monocrops, and reindustrialise France. Therefore, for what they say, anyway, in brackets, is therefore reducing imports and pollution.
Well, I mean, those demands are the sorts of demands that I would agree with, but others have been calling, you know...
Exit from NATO is another one.
Well, I agree with that as well. And, of course, the French have got a tradition of this kind of struggle going back hundreds of years. And so they're building on, you know... They've increased the minimum wage in France. If we went out and started burning down top-level hotels and fighting with the police as they've been doing, would Theresa May's government raise the minimum wage? Or we all end up dead? This is a different country, isn't it?
Scrupulously respect, they say, international law and the treaties we have signed.
Well, yeah. I mean, all of that I think is interesting.
Migrants, they say, about preventing migratory flows that cannot be accommodated or integrated given the profound civilizational crisis we are experiencing. They're definitely not saying no asylum seekers, but they're saying that the number of migrants needs to be reduced.
Well, what I'd say to those people is your president, Sarkozy, along with Cameron, destroyed Gaddafi's Libya, which has opened the floodgates to all these people arriving.
Yeah, but and if not you then. Said,
No. I would say to all of those people, if you supported that, then I'm afraid you've got to deal with the consequences.
How many people do support the wars?
Well, in Britain, David Cameron had popular support for bombing Libya. I didn't support it, you didn't support it, but some people did. And then they're going to say, well, we don't want any refugees. No, you said it was going to be a pushover. Invading Iraq. Both France and Germany voted against invading Iraq.
We had nearly 3 million people on the streets saying no to Iraq. Well, I mean, what happens is these wars are launched by our governments, not by the people.
No, but I mean, the people often go along. wrong with them at the short run.
Any choice?
They do and don't. But I mean, if you supported the invasion of Iraq, there's no point saying that we don't want to have refugees.
Anyway, I'll put a link up to that.
They're going to be refugees, aren't they?
They didn't say that in this. For example, they've not said no refugees. They've said no migrants. So they're talking about economic migrants, not refugees and not asylum seekers. Quite pointedly, in fact. So I'll put a link up to the Gilets Jaunes on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Coming now to Macron and his address to the Republic, which he made, I think it was on Sunday, after some of the trouble over in France. The fact of the matter was, though, that he certainly did not impress. If you look at the French press, the protesters, they say basically, yeah, it's all nice words, but we don't trust this guy.
Dear French citizens,
voilà ensemble,
we are here today, together, discussing the future of our country. The events of the last week in the Hexagon in France have troubled the nation.
Ils ont mêlé des revendications légitimes,
there was legitimate
claims. Inadmissible.
However, there was a chain of inadmissible violence. And I'd like to talk about it. This violence will not benefit anyone.
Well, I mean, Macron is obviously in a weak position politically, but constitutionally, he can't be removed very easily.
There's a few more things we need to really say about the terrorist, so-called, anyway, terrorist attack in Strasbourg. I mean, I said it right at the top of the hour. This guy's dead, like so many of the others, so there won't be any kind of court case.
Well, indeed. What strikes me as very odd is they knew he'd done it immediately, because apparently he got a taxi and left his passport around and all the rest of it, the usual story, and now he's dead, and we never know whether he did it or not.
Sharif Shekat was his name. Had he had any kind of contact with the police?
Oh, he had loads of contact with the police, and in fact, he's wanted for non-Islamist correct crimes. Yeah, he was basically a bank robber and stuff like this. So he basically looks like a patsy to me.
Why?
Why? Because he's now dead, and maybe he'd got no Islamist background, according to the German police, but he was a criminal, and therefore a very useful person to pin it all on.
In the politics of France at the moment, then?
Well, the deep state in France needed a diversion. I'm not saying this is what happened, but it's perfectly reasonable for us to say that this what may have happened. In 1993, the bombings in Paris were carried out by the Algerian secret service, even though it was blamed on the GIA.
The Yellow Vests
Yellow
Vests erected a guillotine in Paris, bearing French President Macron's political party's name, and a revolt has forced Macron to address the future nation. That was on Monday evening this week. But a guillotine, putting up a guillotine with old Marsh on it.
Well, I mean, there's going to be demonstrations tomorrow. Although the stuff I've been reading on the Saker from people based in France says that's probably going to die out over the Christmas period, because these things usually do.
People okay, Macron's appeal
double
to
down, you know.
Macron's appeal to the French from behind the gold desk left the protesters unimpressed.
Well, Macron's fundamental problem is he doesn't have a lot of popular support. He was only voted for by the left in France to keep Le Pen out. And that was the only reason they voted for him. And now, if there'd been a different choice, they wouldn't have voted for him.
His trajectory, he worked for 4 years for the Rothschild Bank in Paris, which is one of those banks that Mayor Amschel Rothschild set up around about 1800, isn't it? Vienna, I'm trying to remember them. Vienna, Naples, London, Paris, and Frankfurt, I suppose, would be the other one, which is the original one. And then he went straight into a job under Hollande in the finance ministry.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely a financial services sector insider. And the only reason that he won was because he got through to the second round, because the votes are always split in the first round in French presidential elections. And then it was him versus Marine Le Pen, and therefore the left voted for him to keep Marine Le Pen out. But he had no popular support as such. He's frittered away whatever little he had by the policies he's pursuing.
Someone with a bit of a sense of humour down at Somerset Live, based in Yeovil, and they are internet news, and it goes into some of the local papers. Time to fight back. The Yellow Vest protests could take to Somerset streets over lunatic councillor greed. Let's start something, they hear in Westminster. That's the subtitle for this. Yellow Vest type protests are set to erupt in Somerset as outrage has been expressed over councillors proposing to give themselves huge pay rises. Violent demonstrations in France recently. Protesters wearing iconic yellow vests are set to pour into the streets of Bridgewater after local councillors proposed a one-third expenses increase?
Well, we shall see. But there's certainly been copycat stuff going on in the Netherlands and Belgium. I think what we need in this country is a red vests protest, so that it's quite clear where we're coming from. We want an increase in minimum wages and so on. I mean, they've increased the minimum wage in France as a result of the protests. Can you imagine that happening here if we went to the streets and forced the government to increase the minimum wage?
About the China-Canada row, tit-for-tat thing here, basically started by Washington. So it was last week, it was a Huawei financial officer arrested in Canada, now two arrested over in China, senior Canadian people.
Well, yes, but of course the Canadians are basically just acting as, cat's paws for the Americans. So arresting Canadian business people is not really going to... I saw a very interesting article earlier. Sheldon Adelson, who's the biggest funder of US politics, do you know where he gets his money from? Running casinos in Macau, which is actually under Chinese control.
So Macau is Portugal.
Well, no, but it's a bit like Hong Kong. It's a bit like Hong Kong. And what they could easily do is close down his casinos in Macau, which would knock his net worth by several billion in one go.
Okay, so a second Canadian...
As a retaliation.
A second Canadian has been detained in China on accusations of harming national security as tension continues between the two countries. It was confirmed on Thursday that Michael Spavor, a businessman, had been detained in addition to the former diplomat Michael Kovrig. Canada drew Chinese protests after it arrested the executive of telecoms giant Huawei at the request of the US. Meng Huanzhou has been bailed but may face extradition for fraud. She denies violating US sanctions in Iran, although Huawei's business dealings in China has threatened unspecified consequences if she is not released. So they're saying it's fraud. Actually, all she's doing is she's trading between China and Iran, which is perfectly legal to do.
It's not legal. The Americans believe that when they say you're not allowed to trade with Iran, that has the force of international law, even though she's broke no law in China and no law outside the United States.
Is this a law passed by the UN at the Security Council?
No, of course not.
Well, I'm with me.
So in other words, she hasn't actually done, what they're accusing her of isn't even a crime. But
so
of course,
do you think she'll be extradited?
I think she will be. I mean, there's no point going through with this unless they're going to do that. But, of course, the Chinese were shocked by all of this. There's some dispute about whether Trump knew about this or not, because when it happened, Trump was actually talking to Xi Jinping. And he was talking, and they were talking about having a truce in the trade war.
But isn't this the way Trump operates? He actually likes to up the ante, and he sees this as upping the stakes.
Well, I think the person who's probably behind this is John Bolton. Yeah. It seems that he definitely knew in advance that this was going to happen, and he okayed it. Yeah, we're going to take this woman down.
And we're now turning into a game of chicken, aren't we?
It is a game of chicken, but of course what's happened in China, from a political point of view, the Chinese population are rallying behind... This family are the top entrepreneurs in China. They've put loads of people to work. They're like Sir Alan Sugar or whatever, or Dyson. And the idea that their woman entrepreneur can just be arrested like this is making... social media in China is exploding with nationalist rage. So if you were trying to make the Chinese calm down, that wasn't the way to do it.
You know what? This is what the military call hardening the sides. In other words, making two... I mean, this is a kind of crisis initiation technique.
It is. And, of course, they may well... Because since the Chinese Communist Party is holding the US national debt, it could end up being with tears before bedtime, couldn't it?
Trump has also committed to a $750 billion US defence budget just a week after saying that far less than that, actually... $30 billion less than that is crazy. So he seems to be basically doing exactly what he's told by the military-industrial complex, by the deep state these days.
He does, yeah. And one interesting thing that was on RT this week, I was reading on the website, the Pentagon, when it puts in money requests, doesn't always spend the money that it's requested. And that money then gets squirreled away in a slush fund, which is bigger than the entire military budget of the US and China combined. But they keep coming back saying we want more money, even though they've got this big slush fund with money that they previously had, because they haven't spent it, they just keep it.
Looking at Pakistan, Imran Khan, the president there, has said Pakistan will no longer be America's hired gun. He said that, really, he's saying a break with the United States. We don't trust you guys anymore.
Well, that's what's happening.
Of course, it's a nuclear power, Pakistan.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, all over the world, people are realising that the Americans are flaky. minimally flaky, not to be trusted. And of course, Trump is making people think we're going to have to make alternative arrangements.
Also,
here,
two Russian nuclear-capable bombers have gone to Venezuela for joint exercises to defend Maduro against effectively a US oil grab, which they're trying to do via Brazil and Colombia. Now, that's my spin on the headline, but certainly that's what's going. I mean, it seems to me that's what's going on. The deployment follows Venezuelan President Maduro's talks with Putin in Moscow last week.
Well, the obvious riposte to the...
It's actually the biggest oil reserves anywhere in the world, isn't it, Venezuela? And the Americans want to get their hands on it.
Well, they've also been for years trying to get rid of the Chavista regime in Venezuela.
Maduro was, I believe, his foreign minister, Chavez's foreign minister.
He was originally, yeah, but of course when Chavez was probably assassinated by the US, because he died of very mysterious cancer, as many other Latin American leaders have done, Maduro took over, former bus driver, obviously not one of us. But of course...
Staying in that part of the world, though, 14 Israelis are suspected this week of running a child sex trafficking ring in Colombia. The network allegedly marketed trips from Israel for tourists to have sex with minors who were forced into prostitution. Six Israelis have been held by the Colombian government and arrest warrants issued for more suspects. That is another 12 Israelis.
Well, the Israelis were very involved in supporting the military dictatorships in Latin America, and of course the Colombian army is armed with Galil rifles, which are Israeli manufacture. So in actual fact, in Latin America, they are regarded as, apart from Bolsonaro's boys in Brazil, the Israelis are regarded as persona non grata.
He's taking
for obvious
over,
reasons.
Isn't he? He's taking over in the new year, Bolsonaro. This guy is a bit of a far right, I think we can even say neo-Nazi.
Indeed. And, of course, he will help support any kind of intervention in Venezuela. But, of course, the left are about to take over in Mexico. Obrador is about to take over in January. We shall see what happens with all of this. But, the obvious thing for the Russians to do if the INF treaty is going to be cancelled is to put some nuclear missiles into Cuba. No problem there, surely. I mean, if you can put missiles in our face, we can put them in your face.
Well, that's
sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander.
A rerun of the Cuban missile
crisis. Well, it would be, wouldn't it?
A decision to assassinate Yasser Arafat apparently was approved by the Saudis. A former senior Saudi advisor has said, well, as a kind of a meltdown in Saudi Arabia with Mohammed bin Salman, it seems that quite a lot of former senior diplomats and officials coming out of the woodwork. Former senior advisor to Yasser Arafat, the late leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization, said that Arafat's death was not natural. He was actually assassinated, with Saudi Arabia approving the decision. He spoke in an exclusive interview with Palestine's Arabic language Shehab news agency. Bassam Abu Sharif said former US President George W. Bush had contacted Saudi officials after a meeting with the former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, during which Arafat's liquidation was agreed. Saudi authorities consented.
Well, there we are. So somebody else's political leader can just be assassinated like that. And meanwhile, we carry on trading with Saudi Arabia, selling loads of weaponry to kill everybody in Yemen. And of course, what we've really got to have is sanctions on Russia about the Skripals affair, which we probably orchestrated ourselves.
Sharon,
couldn't make it up, could you?
Sharon met with Bush at the White House and told him he could no longer keep his promise of not physically attacking Yasser Arafat because he was a leading terror figure collaborating with Hamas, and that Hamas's operations were carried out with the approval and blessing of Arafat, a senior member of the PLO. So he's basically saying that the guy's a terrorist.
Well, lots of people out there are terrorists, and therefore, if we're not going to have a rule of law, then everybody be looking under their cars every morning, because somebody, retaliation is built into these things ultimately, isn't it?
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you're going to play it by if there's no rules, then there's no rules, Tony, is there? No rules. The IRA nearly killed two Tory prime ministers in this country. They were unlucky on the day both times.
Who were they?
Margaret Thatcher and John Major.
Okay, so let's move on now to have a listen to someone who's died this week, an author, writer, bit of a brilliant guy, all-round guy, actually. His name's William Bloom, and here he is speaking on the Abby Martin show. Not quite sure whether that was her RT one or her Telesur English from Venezuela programme. He was talking really about his book, America's Deadliest Export, Democracy.
I wanted you to talk about how the corporate state plays a role in the imperialism that we see today.
Well, they are one of the main beneficiaries of these policies. For decades and decades, they have been able to overthrow governments which were hostile to any kind of socialism. You know, socialism is the main enemy of American corporations here and overseas. And they need a government in place which is going to be sympathetic to free enterprise in its full glory. And so we have attempted to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders since the end of the Second World War. That's more than 50 leaders. We have attempted to overthrow more than 50 countries in the same time period. We have attempted to, we actually bombed more than 30 countries since 1945 and so on. I've compiled it all. I was amazed myself how much there was. When I began, I had no idea there was this much to uncover. But we have to keep doing this to keep from power any government which is not going to be sympathetic to the aims of the multinational corporations. And that's why we hate the Cubans so much. The Cubans have never apologized for throwing out capitalism, and they have infected the entire Latin America with their philosophy. That can't be excused. That's why Cuba is a perpetual enemy and an object of hatred, and it'll be the way forever.
That's William Bloom. Sadly died this week, aged 85. Not one single mention anywhere in the UK national press at all about him. A bit in the US, but nothing whatsoever here, Martin.
Well, that's right. People are basically ignorant about the way the world works, aren't they, in this country? You know, they don't know what they ought to know about the way things are really done.
They're deliberately being kept ignorant.
Well, they are, yes. And of course, a lot of infotainment, which people think is news, doesn't make them learn anything useful that they need to know.
Also, this week, the IMF is warning that storm clouds are gathering for the global economy. One of the IMF's top officials has warned on Tuesday that storm clouds are gathering. The government and central banks might not be well equipped to cope. Now, we get these sort of warnings periodically. The fund has been trying to urge governments to fix the roof during the sunny last 2 years for the world economy. The IMF first deputy managing director, David Lipton, said. But like many of you, I see storm clouds building. Apparently, they will be stopping doing quantitative easing. That sounds, like it's not might not be the best time to do that, since we're going into the whole Brexit business next spring. Mm-hmm. That will actually, surely, if they stop doing QE, will that actually make the economy fragile?
Are we talking about Britain or the global economy?
The Eurozone.
Well, the Eurozone, yeah. I mean, what's happening is we're now reaching the point where the Federal Reserve have started to rein back on QE and raise interest rates, and it's only a matter of time before, you know, the elastic snaps. And there's the same thing's happening in the Eurozone, and at some point the elastic's going to snap. It may snap in Britain first because of our particular obsession with Brexit, but it won't make that much difference.
Why might QE make that more or less likely to happen?
Well, the markets have become addicted to free money provided by the government, which they then take away and invest in speculative bubbles. And they've made a packet out of all of this. And of course, as long as they get out in time, they'll be fine, because you can short your way out of it as long as you guess at the right moment when you're going to pull the plug. And of course, what will then happen is that the too big to fail banks will then hopefully be bailed out by the government again, and that's what they're hoping. And then they can buy everything up for pennies on the dollar when it all crashes. But the social impact of this is going to be absolutely horrendous. And it's been coming. We've had 10 years to try and sort this out, and not only has nothing been done. In actual fact, the problems that led to the financial crisis in 2008 have been intensified by the policies that have been pursued. That's because the people involved have got too much power. They had too much power before, and they've actually consolidated that power. And that's who really runs
the European Central Bank's problem. Apparently, is that the growth is weaker than expected. And the outlook is clouded by a threat of global trade war, the prospect of a hard Brexit and Italy's budget standoff with the European Commission. But quantitative easing has run its course. Any extension would have hit the European Central Bank's credibility after it flagged the scheme's end this just a couple of months ago. In the end, the ECB tweaked the wording of its statement to reflect the increased economic concerns, but kept its reference to balanced risks. So QE, that's it. We've had enough of that. No more. For the euro.
Well, what may happen is that after the crash, they'll try and reinstate it, but it would be too late because you've already lost, you'll have lost so much GNP by that stage that it won't work. And ultimately, we're going to have to go to the kind of...
Why can't we just do QE for the people? In other words, QE money rather than going into the stock market, stock exchanges, going to the government so that the government's got money things, invest in projects and actually get jobs going, that kind of thing. A bit like the New Deal from Roosevelt before World War II.
Yeah, well, I mean, Varoufakis has been putting forward a Green New Deal for Europe programme this week, and of course that is the way to go. The problem is that the governments have become, basically all of their resources have been spent propping up the banking system, so they've got no resources to give to the people because they've all gone somewhere else.
Draghi has said he's stuck, basically saying that the QE is the only thing which has been driving growth at all over the last few years, so really it's a kind of fictional growth they've been having.
Well, indeed. The whole thing is an illusion based on pretending. It's what Varoufakis called extend and pretend. And at a certain point, we are going to hit the buffers.
Okay,
and when we do, it's not going to be funny.
So, what with the end of QE and Brexit possibly precipitating this, it was nice that I bumped into a chap called John Coward earlier this week, who's a former Lloyds banker. And he had quite a lot to say about the current malaise with banking and also what we should do about it.
My name is John Coward. I'm part owner of a company, or little business called Licorice Heaven. I worked in for the bank with the black horse. And when I started banking many, many years ago, you worked your way up from the shop floor to top dog. You knew the intricacies there. And one of my old bosses said, we're the only company that once sometimes got to ask for its stock back because we lend money and we need to get it back. And what I think happened just before the boom time is that they were bringing in people perhaps who didn't have a banking upbringing. So big bang came in and a lot of people thought there's a lot of money to be made. Now, we're not talking about the merchant banks. We're talking more, the mortgage market, etc. And the people who at the top people were coming in from other industries, and they didn't grasp the nettle that selling banking products is different than selling, dare I say it, holidays or whatever. Because at the end of the day, you've got to lend to someone who can pay you back. And all they wanted to do, and again, this is very controversial, is they were lending on either an asset like a house, not really realizing that the value of the house could go down because they think they could always sell the house. And of course, that permit, in America with the two big companies over there, what they used to call them, Fannie Mae, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
This is going back quite a few times. And then people then suddenly said, well, this we're lending to people who can't repay, but the asset that we were going to sell to get our money back isn't there. And of course then the market crashed and banks have been lending to other banks on the strength of their asset book on these properties, and then suddenly everyone thought, well, this company is lent to people it shouldn't do with assets which aren't that strong, and that was what clogged it up. And the banking was based on trust, and it just went spiraling down. I can remember back in the old days is that we would always, when I was lending money, my first thing is, can this person pay? And will he pay? Not, I'm going to get, on the asset. I was lending to the person if he could pay back. And a lot of my customers, when I said, well, look, unfortunately, you can't buy this five-bedroom detached house. You're going to have to sell for a four-bedroom. They wanted the five-bedroom. They borrowed too much through another company, one of these secondary lenders. And, of course, it all went pear-shaped.
there's definitely big changes gone on in banking, and one wishes almost that we could get some of the old bankers back.
Yeah, I mean, the best bosses I had were guys and women who started on the what I'd call the shop floor, you know, on the cashiers, etc. And they knew, and they had to get banking exams. So I had to get 10 3-hour banking exams. So I had 10 exams each of 3 hours to be, so say, competent in lending. Well, that's all gone out the window.
Now, Gordon Brown said back in 2008, I think it was a slip, I'm not sure if he meant to say it, but he said, I saved the world. Actually, what's happened is we've now got an even bigger bubble. We've got money printing going on. We've got massively overvalued share prices and overvalued property prices, and yet this banks are still lending. It does make it sound as if history could repeat itself. I wonder what you think.
Well, that's, one doesn't know what's in the future. I mean, all I would say is if you actually look on what's called salary multiples, how much people are lent, I think the actual salary multiples compared to what people were earning is about the same as they were in the 70s, which is when people are earning sort of £1,800 a year. If you multiply that up, that will be the size of the mortgage. So if you, I don't know what the average wage is now, but if you, you know, if we were lending 4 times somebody's salary, that's what they were doing in the 70s. It's just with inflation, we're talking on bigger numbers.
Also, there's this whole thing called casino banking, which is the merchant banks. They're supposed to be separate to the high street banks, but are they?
Yeah. Well, merchant banking is, that's the ones that have got a bad reputation because, you know, all this hedge funds and all that, they can manipulate the markets. We don't want to go too far there. And, the big merchant banks, that is where they make big money by, they can manipulate the markets.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you the final question. Mark Carney has decided to quit. They've given you the job, someone who's an old hand. Is there anything that you would say? Say you were sitting in the Governor of the Bank of England's position and saying, you know, okay, John, what do we do?
Well, first of all, I'd make sure that we firm up the Financial Services Act. So people have got to be registered, fully registered, inspected regularly. It is coming. So that you get rid of these cowboy lenders. I would definitely agree with splitting merchant banks with ordinary retail banks. That is the thing. And I would put the directors legally responsible. I know on paper they are, but anybody caught doing something wrong, personally, they go to jail. That's the first things I would do.
And how do you rate the governors, Mark Carney and Mervyn King?
I like Mervyn King, Lord King. I think he was very good. Mark Carney, he's done a few. If they've got a difficult job, let's not make any bones of it. But I think he overacted when we voted to come out of the EU by reducing interest rates. And I think he has admitted that it was a wrong thing. He sent out the wrong signals. I'm not an expert, but I do think he tends to overreact. And the problem with what he says can affect the markets. And you've got to be very careful what you say. Because,
well, surely in that case, the Bank of England governor shouldn't say anything.
Well, that is a good question. There's something to be said for there, but then he's got his actions, isn't he? That sends signals to the markets. And the markets, a lot of these are very volatile because there are speculators involved to make a quick few pounds.
Yeah, or a few million. Bit naughty, isn't it? Manipulating the markets. That was John Coward at Licorice Heaven, former Lloyds banker. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi, we hope. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
On the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.